Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. It's Travis, and today we're going to talk about what the potential student loan reforms that are being debated by Congress right now could mean for married borrowers. Now, I do not want to exclude the single borrowers out there and the engaged borrowers out there. We value you greatly too. I just thought that this is a relevant group of people that could use an episode entirely devoted to it. I'm going to actually still talk to single borrowers and engaged borrowers at the very end and not leave you out. I'm just going to start the show off today just addressing kind of some thoughts for married borrowers and soon-to-be married borrowers in particular that have a lot of student loans about what all these reform proposals mean for you and could mean for you. And, you know, if you are in the mood to write your congressperson or senator what you would need to share with them in terms of your concerns, if you're concerned by anything you listen in this podcast. Everyone that listens to this podcast regularly knows that the Repayment Assistance Plan, RAP, is the proposal for the one IDR plan to rule them all that the GOP wants to make the only option for anybody who takes out loans for the first time after July 2026. Now, borrowers with loans before that would be able to choose between the RAP plan or the old IBR plan under their proposals so far, so long as there's no other loans, you know, being repaid on. You can't pay loans on one plan and a couple loans on another one. You got to pay them all on one, basically. The House proposal put forward two options, old IBR for, you know, everybody that's already on a repayment plan, and then the RAP plan that you could maybe switch into or, you know, that people taking out loans for the future would use. And in the RAP plan, it specifically states that you could file separately for taxes and use it and have only your income be counted for it. But the Senate version of the bill that was put forward says the RAP plan would not allow borrowers to file taxes separately. And that's very alarming. That's very concerning. And I'm going to explain why they did it. It's because the Senate basically has always said, the Republicans in the Senate specifically, have always stated that they want the one plan to be the repay plan. That has been their position since at least, I think, several years. And when I say their plan, I mean like the center of the Republican caucus, like John Cornyn, Senator Cornyn of Texas, or whoever's chairing the Republican Education Committee at the time. Their proposal that they've stated is always that there should be one repayment plan and it should be repay because that was good enough for President Obama, therefore it should be good enough for everybody. That's kind of, that was their logic. And the repay plan does not allow married filing separate. It requires you to include your spouse's income in the payment. Now, the difference is that the repay plan was one plan out of other options. Their proposals at the time would take away everything but repay for everybody. But the problem with that is it creates a very large disincentive to become married, and if you're already married, to stay married in extreme circumstances for borrowers with a lot of student loan debt. So let's just think about this rationally. If repay was the only plan, the repay plan is the old version that was around before the pandemic that, you know, became save and then now is going to become something else. But if you had to pay 10%, let's say you have $600,000 of loans from dental school and you're a dentist that makes $150,000, right? And you meet a great guy or gal and you want to get married, and then you say, hey, it's a little awkward, but I've got to go for forgiveness no matter what because I have four times my income in debt, in student debt, and I know you make a good salary of $100,000, and unfortunately, we're going to have to include your income too in my payments. So we're going to have to take, they're going to take 10% of your income, which is 10% of, you know, $100,000 is about 10 grand, right, a year. And that 10 grand, instead of you getting to keep, it's going to have to go into my loans. A little unromantic, right? There are worse things. I already pay a lot more in taxes, I believe, being married to my wife than I would if we were single. Is that a reason to strategically divorce my wife? No, because if I did suggest something like that, I would get a strategic punch in the face, probably from her, right? So I think that any high-income couple that is married to one another is already paying a lot more in taxes, probably, than you don't even realize it. One example is the 3.8% tax on net investment income starts at 200K for single couples, but or single people, but 250K for married couples. That's a much lower threshold that you pay that almost 4% tax on interest and investment income if you're married. There's other things as well, right? So it's sort of like, if you're married, you already are paying a lot more in taxes. And, you know, to put myself in the seat of a economist with dictatorial power that has the rights to pull the levers of power however they want to. Like, let's pretend that person existed, right? Let's say you have a king and they were trying to utility maximize. You would tax married couples at more punitive rates than single individuals. Why? Because married couples accumulate wealth at much faster rates than people of other marital statuses. And that's just because married couples share expenses. They have two incomes instead of one. They often will have one person that has better benefits than the other. So you rely on the better benefits for the one spouse that cover the whole family. There's just a lot of wealth growth that happens when you're married just because of economies of scale compared to when you're not. And also, on the lower end of the scale, being married is enormously advantageous for married couples because if you have one higher income person married to a lower income person, you know, you're getting taxed as if, you know, you're each two single individuals making about, you know, basically you're in a lower tax bracket. That's a better way to say it. Like, if you're married, one person's high income, one person's low income, and you file joint, you know, you basically get much larger tax brackets to get taxed at rates like 22 and 24%. And you don't get taxed into the higher 30-something percent rates until you're making a lot more income. So they kind of do things like do the ACA tax, the 4% tax to fund the ACA. They have that taken into effect at like much lower thresholds for married couples because they're trying to kind of make up for the fact that married couples are a lot wealthier and grow wealth faster and can really honestly afford to pay more taxes than single individuals can. With that same logic, you can see why some of the people in the Senate would think, well, we shouldn't have married filing separate for student loans because that's just only something that benefits high-income couples. Well, the problem is it's one thing when you're talking about like a 3.8% net investment income tax. People probably ignore that or don't pay attention to that much. But it's a whole nother ballgame when you're talking about a 10% tax on somebody's income. I mean, that's very large. 10% is very, very large. Somebody's going to notice that and somebody's going to be aware of that and somebody will want to share that with their spouse, most likely or prospective spouse, just so that that's something that they're aware of before you actually go through the legal process of getting married. You know, marriage is on the long-term downward trend anyway in the USA. And, you know, student loan borrowers are a relatively small percentage of the overall population, especially six-figure borrowers are. So would this, you know, dramatically cause a single-handedly a decline in marriage rates if the Senate's version of RAP were to pass? No, it would not. But at the same time, it would definitely discourage a lot of these edge cases from people getting married or even, you know, I think, you know, just to give you kind of some background, back when repay was a much cheaper plan than IBR for people that were single. So they wouldn't, this is just a scenario where somebody's not eligible for pay. They were eligible for repay and old IBR. That was the only time back in the day I used to have conversations where somebody might be incentivized to do a strategic divorce. And pretty much everybody always was interested in knowing the numbers, but almost always the answer was, well, we'll just pay the higher 5% hit to our income because that isn't something that we want to do. It's getting a strategic divorce. It just doesn't make sense for us. That was almost always the math that people opted for back in the day, but I think 10% might be a little different. Like, you know, I mean, it wouldn't be, I think still the majority of people would choose to not be strategically divorcing just because it's going to save one of them 10% of their income. But I do think that there would be a lot more people than, you know, a handful, which is the only group of people that thought about doing it if this were to pass. Now, what I think is a lot more likely is that it would slow down people getting married in the first place. So if you know that you're going to have your spouse's income be hit by a 10% hit from your student loans, if you knew that was going to happen, you'd maybe choose just to kind of live in a permanent spiritual marriage, which is legal. You can obviously get married in front of a religious authority or somebody, anybody you want, and then two people can say they're married while not legally being married. You know, for example, if you never turn in the marriage certificate, there's like common law marriage laws in some states, right? But like if you never turn in the marriage certificate in general, you know, your tax return says you're single, but your heart could tell you you're married. I actually had a pretty interesting conversation once with one of my pastors growing up who told me about this interesting story of older people who would come to him worried about, quote, living in sin because their spouse has passed, but their deceased spouse had left them, you know, survivor's benefits or a pension survivorship benefit that they would lose if they got remarried or that they would potentially lose if they got remarried. And they were in their, many cases, their 80s, this pastor was saying, and were, you know, wanting companionship again, but also didn't want to get in trouble so soon to going to heaven, right? So it's kind of an interesting problem, theological problem, you could say, that he confronted. And that's when I learned that apparently the very common answer that these couples would figure out is that they would get married spiritually in front of the pastor and then, you know, ask him to not turn in the marriage certificate. And that was something that they did. You know, that was the first time I actually even heard of the idea of being spiritually married, but legally not married. Obviously, some people just that are not legally married, but in a long-term partnership, just consider themselves in a long-term partnership and might not believe in marriage as an institution. Whatever your view on it is, that's fine. I'm just trying to share some funny stories and also just to kind of share what I expect would happen if this RAP plan were to go through, right? I think 10% of income, people are not going to want that to apply to their spouses. Now, if it did occur, I think what you would see with the Senate plan, if they did make everybody on the RAP file jointly, I think you would see a lot of existing borrowers have to make the choice between filing separately with IBR or filing jointly and doing the RAP plan. Now, it's not just apples and apples when it comes to the deduction that you get. So a lot of people could get a very high deduction on IBR because of the 150% of discretionary income, whereas on the RAP plan, you only get to deduct about $50 per month per child that you have. So the deduction is way lower on the RAP plan than the IBR plan is, especially for families that have a lot of children. That could be a really big impact. Now, if you both have student loans, generally speaking, you file jointly, but that math may or may not be different with the IBR plan. If it goes through as intended, we'll see what happens. We're just going to continue to monitor the situation. Now, if I was a married borrower with a lot of student loans, let's pretend that I'm the only one with the student loans, and let's say that my spouse does not have student loans, I would feel pretty good about continuing on the IBR plan, filing taxes separately to exclude my spouse from having to pay 15% of their income too. In many ways, if this bill passes, the importance of filing taxes separately and minimizing AGI is only going to grow. If you wanted to dodge 10% hits on your income, if this bill passes and you're paying 15%, then you would want to dodge that impact on your income even more. So pre-tax accounts, tax-deferred accounts, HSAs, those sorts of things would become more important, not less important. Same with like dependent care, flexible spending accounts. You know, these are things that our team is monitoring really closely. And you know, our team at SLP Wealth for financial planning clients is thinking about very carefully as this bill progresses through the Senate. And, you know, it's already progressed through the House. Now, what comes next? You know, we're going to have that bill go back. It's going to have to pass the Senate. So if it passes the Senate, then I think, you know, this thing's definitely happening, right? If the bill passes the Senate, that's the big thing to test. If it doesn't pass the Senate, which would be absolutely stunning to me if it doesn't, to be honest with you, then the bill wouldn't go forward. Let's think about the composition of the Senate. 53 Republican senators with the tie-breaking vote with Vice President J.D. Vance, right? You can afford to lose Murkowski and Collins, two moderates. You can afford to lose McConnell, who feels sort of unburdened with his responsibilities no longer as leader of the caucus, right? He's been voting against the Trump administration a lot more. So you've got three senators, let's pretend, are going to vote no on it, hypothetically. Then it all comes down to, you know, maybe some of these other random ones like Senator Tillis or Senator Ron Johnson. Now, these are not necessarily uniformly moderates, but some of them have their own problems with the bill that are like, basically some of them think it's not conservative enough. Some think it's maybe that some are prioritizing the tax cuts. That's the thing that they really want to make sure happens. Some people want to split the bill up into tax cuts and then other things. Well, if they do that, it's pretty likely that a lot of those other priorities are not going to go anywhere at all. We just have to wait and see. I think just to be honest here, and I'll talk to the single borrowers too on this, you know, if you tell all student loan borrowers that the promises that were made by prior Congresses are null and void and their new requirement is they have to pay 50% more, and you penalize borrowers that are married, who are often probably a lot more likely to vote than people that are not married, I think on average, if you do all that politically, I think this is really going to be damaging to Republicans. And it's not just that they're doing, they're also capping loans. So the one sort of, you could say, positive, if you want to use that word, on the Senate bill compared to the House is the Senate said 200K for loan limits. The House said 150K. This is for professional school. And also the aggregate limit for Parent PLUS borrowers was 50K in the House bill, and it was 65K aggregate limit for the Senate bill. there's going to be a giant sucking sound of university jobs going away and universities closing when and if this passes. Because if you think about like taxing endowments and you're capping loan limits, I'm just thinking about the economic impact. And I'll just give you this random example, right? There's this really fun bar arcade near where I live, and it's really fun. And they have this nice private meeting room. And I always see big groups from Duke University running out the room, right? And what is Duke? Duke has a lot of revenue from their endowment. They have a lot of revenue for NIH. They have a lot of revenue from student loans, you know, and their graduate programs, you know, and how expensive many of the programs are. But if you tax endowments in a big way, like Duke's endowment, if you cap loan limits at a fraction of the amount that you could borrow even like 20 years ago, not even adjusting for inflation, and you've already taken back a lot of these NIH grants and such, you know, you're going to see a massive drop off in jobs at institutions, even the, you know, prestigious ones like a Duke, right? And, you know, multiply that by like 100 other universities, actually hundreds of universities across the country. And, you know, a name like Duke's going to survive on the kind of sports fan kind of side of me for a second too. There was this big NCAA settlement that now the schools have to pay tens of millions of dollars to their athletes because of the house settlement. They used to just bank all that money in profits. So, you know, you are going from tons of research money, tons of endowment money that's not taxed, massive TV deals that you're earning money from. The flush times at universities are over. And so when a lot of these changes occur, what happens to businesses like that bar arcade that makes probably a big chunk of its profits from that one big customer, all of the different Duke graduate school programs that rent out that space and order bar snacks and pizzas and have alcohol tabs and minimums they have to hit, tokens they buy to play the games? And then what happens to employment at those places when they have to cut a third of their wait staff or a quarter of their bartenders because they can't afford to pay them because they're not able to get tipped out enough? What happens when you cap all these loan limits at all of these rural and suburban districts where the university employer, which is super dependent upon Parent PLUS loans at this random private art liberal arts school that's been around for 100 years but doesn't have a big endowment? What happens when you cut a quarter of their revenues and they can't replace it with wealthy students from families that are having fewer kids, right? Now, they're already under pressure because of demographic trends, right? Because the millennials have already mostly finished college. And so you have smaller generations coming behind, but you're also punching these universities in the mouth as hard as you can with all these changes that are happening. And if the loan limit changes pass, it doesn't happen immediately where your loan limits are capped, but it happens very quickly in the next couple years or so where you're not able to get much borrowing anymore from the federal government, which means that everything is underwritten by private lenders if this happens. And those private lenders are going to have very strict underwriting criteria, and they are only going to finance the most prestigious schools and the families from, you know, with the highest incomes, highest assets, and highest credit scores. Or they'll charge a risk-adjusted, much higher interest rate in the folks that don't have those criteria if they allow them to borrow at all. So one thing I'll say is, if this picture appears bleak, I think that the pendulum is essentially is swinging very, very hard against, you know, it's fair to say, the abuse of the higher ed institutions of the public, which was, let's just charge anything we want because we can get away with it, and we can tell everybody they have to sign up for IBR, and we can, they'll say yes to it. So let's just, you know, raise our tuition every year at 7%, not actually, you know, make any hard decisions like cut unnecessary positions or, you know, not have as many administrative staff, right? So instead of doing that, they just all chose, a lot of them chose the easy path of just, let's just keep raising tuition over and over and over again because we can. The pendulum is swinging very hard against that after a big change election, right? Where the American people elected this Congress and this president, right, to make big change because they are very, American people, very angry about different, many different things, right? But, you know, you think about the pandemic and then AI and all the jobs that people are losing because of it. I mean, it's, you know, unless you're already pretty wealthy, it makes sense that a lot of people are angry. And so you have this change election. And then what will happen, though, is, you know, whoever's in charge gets blamed whenever something happens. And so at some point, you will probably see a swing back the other way. And when Democrats have control over Congress or the White House or both, which probably at some point will happen, you know, probably in the next 10 to 12 years, you probably would almost say more likely than not. If that happens, then I expect the student loan pendulum is going to swing super hard in the other direction. Maybe way more borrowing, you know, maybe something way more aggressive than the SAVE plan, maybe vastly expanded jobs that can qualify for PSLF, maybe 5 years until PSLF instead of 10. I mean, you know, we will see the pendulum swing very hard in the opposite partisan direction. So that's why you should not panic about this. Most people, the impact will be 50% higher payments, which is significant, but it's going from 10% of your income to 15% of your income. That is like a very uncomfortable tax increase because that's what it is. If you're on pay and you get kicked onto IBR, the immediate impact of that is instead of paying 10% of your income, you're paying 15. Is that good? No, it's not. But there's a very good chance that you're probably didn't know about or you're missing a lot of loopholes that you could use to lower your taxable income and save more money than the extra cost of your student loans would be anyway. So it's not a catastrophic thing for most families, for people that are already borrowers. The folks that it could really hurt are lower income students that are enrolled in professional school currently, particularly those borrowers of color and those from low income backgrounds. It could hurt folks who are Parent Plus borrowers who have not yet signed up for an IDR plan. I will say that Parent Plus borrowers are being really poorly treated in this bill if it passes, and we're monitoring that situation closely. And I want to confess as a human to you that I'm exhausted. I'm exhausted because I think what's happening to borrowers right now is extremely unfair and it's wrong. And I am going to be fine no matter what financially. It's not about me. I feel like the pain a lot of people that send me messages, and I can sense the stress and the anxiety and the worry. You don't have to believe me, but I don't do this for the money. I don't have to do this for the money because I reached the point of financial independence a little while ago. And so I continue to do this because of my passion for trying to help people. And I don't know, this is not supposed to be a therapy session the way I close out this podcast, but I think that I just want to share it to show you that I know that you're human and I'm human. And it's just, I think, cathartic to just be like, this is freaking hard. This is exhausting. This is tiring. Why can't the rules just stay consistent? The promises made just be the promises kept. And, you know, if you borrowed and you were promised the pay-as-you-earn plan 8 years ago, then why can't it just be that that set of rules rides out into the sunset until your loans are done? And if they want to change the rules, they should change them on people who have not yet made life decisions based off of the rules on the dotted line. But unfortunately, that is not the way this world works. Unfortunately, the Congress is choosing essentially to go very hard in the opposite direction, as hard as they possibly can in the opposite direction to what the Biden administration did. And, you know, kind of what happens in politics, what this shows, I think, right, is what George W. Bush administration did with PSLF and IBR with the Democratic Congress was a, you know, a long-term sustainable thing that they did, a long-term sustainable politically, I mean, thing they did based off of having a Republican president and a Democratic Congress kind of agree on something, right? It passed with something like 79 votes. And then you saw the Obama administration have filibuster-proof majorities, and they passed major overhauls of the whole system. Then the Obama administration itself tried to walk back some of their own things that they did with the repay plan and, you know, talking about capping Parent Plus loans and things like that. But, you know, because of how poisoned the political environment was between Democrats and Republicans, they could not agree on anything that was long-term common sense reform. And so nothing got done. Then you have the first Trump administration and, you know, student loans were really not a focal point for them. It was other things. And, you know, you had the sort of MAGA faction competing against the traditional conservative faction that didn't really fully like or trust each other, I think, to be honest. And then you had the Biden administration win, and his own political vulnerabilities caused him to have to essentially turn over a lot of power to progressives who wanted big, impactful change to student loans, but they did not do it in a sustainable way. And then the reaction now that, you know, you have more of a complete takeover of the Republican Party by President Trump and sort of people that would be loyal to him, Now you're seeing that pendulum go super hard in the opposite direction, which means I think that the pendulum will swing again. And so as a student loan borrower, you have to make the decision. Do you want to be dealing with the swinging pendulum? If your debt-to-income ratio is over 2-to-1, you owe more than 2 times your income, then I think the answer should be yes, you need to stick with it because you'll be wealthier if you do. And if your debt-to-income ratio, you have less debt than your income, then you probably need to get away from the pendulum unless you're on PSLF. And if you're in between those debt-to-income ratios, then you have to make a values-based decision with you and your family as to if this is, if the math supports you sticking with this, and if your stomach can support you sticking with this. I told you that I'm passionate about helping student loan borrowers, and I absolutely am, to the point of exhaustion. I love helping you. I'm going to continue doing this, you know, and I love doing this, and I'm just saying the truth, which is I'm tired, and I know you are too. But together, we will get through this, and let's try to think about things glass half full instead of glass half empty. Let's try to stay positive. Let's try to stay hopeful for the future, because even if this does pass, most people will be in really good shape compared to the average American family. I'm here to help any way that I can. Our team is here to help. If you need a consult or a refresher, studentloanplanner.com/book. If you want more of a comprehensive kind of engagement because you know lowering your AGI and getting all those types of decisions right long-term is going to be more important than ever, you could become an SLP Wealth client at start.slpwealth.com. If you want the discount for joining that. And again, I have to say, I guess that SLP Wealth is a registered SEC registered investment advisor with headquarters in Durham. And just know that if you have questions, I will do my best to get to them. But studentloanplanner.com/voicemail is the link for that. And you can record a question on your phone and we'll try to feature it in an upcoming pod episode. Thank you for being on this journey with me. If you ever want to get off the journey and refinance your loans and never think about this again, I won't take it personally. But I'm here to support you and your family's wealth growth journey and journey towards financial independence. And it's a blessing to have that purpose in my life to help you. Thank you for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. I hope you have a great rest of your week. Are you on the free Student Loan Planner email list? If yes, you can upgrade your experience and discover student loan loopholes so good, they might get repealed if I talk about them publicly. Find out my very best thought leadership that I really just can't be super open about anymore, unfortunately. If you want to get our very best tips, not just the ones that I can share for free, go to studentloanplanner.com/insider to get a special discount for your year membership. That's studentloanplanner.com/insider and get our very best dozens of bonus content and tips that's going to save you money and get you out of student debt faster. And if you're already an SLP insider, please reply back to those emails and let me know how I can make it even more valuable.